I've been looking forward to preaching here for a couple of weeks, and I've been thinking about this text actually since last Sunday. Pastor Jin preached last Sunday on the passages that just precede it on the widow's offering, reflecting on what's going on in the temple at that time with the religious authorities, and I was thinking a lot as he was preaching and thinking through this and looking at this text. And so I've actually had this sermon on my mind for about a week, processing it and looking forward to it. I didn't anticipate, nor was I prepared for Thursday and Friday, and all that transpired. And the text took on a little bit different feel as I looked at it again after and in the midst of these events. So I know a lot of us have been watching carefully the news, but just to name it again for us, Thursday and Friday. Thursday, we know in Beirut, 43 were killed and 180 were injured in South Beirut in a largely civilian area in a suburb in South Beirut. ISIS claimed responsibility as they were especially seeking out some Hezbollah folks. In Paris, then, on Friday night, which we all saw the most in the news coverage, 129 were killed and 352 were wounded. And then in Baghdad, on that very same day, a funeral was struck of a Shiite family. And in that funeral, 26 were killed, 46 were wounded, and then there was also another roadside bomb, 5 killed, 15 wounded. Wars and rumors of wars. It gave this passage a whole other feel, and admittedly, this stuff happens a lot in areas of Baghdad and the surrounding areas, especially going back to 2003 and the invasion there and the occupation. So it's easy not to even catch those anymore as they flash across the news screen. And then when it happens in a Western European nation, it catches all of our attention again. And we see the streaming news. But we grieve all of this. We lament. We mourn. And we don't know what to say or do or how to respond. And I've certainly felt that as well. So I sat with this text yesterday. And I read over it again and again, and I kind of regretted choosing it. Not because I don't think it's an important text and doesn't have something to say to our situation today, but two things. One is I know the temptation in the church of interpreting this text a certain way, and that is reading it as if it is talking about Christians and our own sense of persecution or victimization. And too often throughout church history, that has been vis-a-vis, this goes back to Europe, all the way back to 1000, even earlier, vis-a-vis Islam. And it's much too easy to take events in the Middle East and to read Islam into some of this and then start scapegoating. And it quickly devolves into an Islamophobia, a blaming, and an imagination of some sort of holy war. And we have a theology, premillennial dispensationalism, that has just gone run rampant throughout churches in this country, and it fuels that, and writings fuel that. And so we don't know how to even read passages like this anymore once we start to go away from that. What is this text saying if it's not talking about some sort of apocalyptic future events? How do we make sense of this text when it sounds like Jesus is forecasting wars and rumors of wars, and do not be alarmed as nation rises against nation and kingdom against kingdom? And we read this as a sign of the end times, and then we look at the events in the Middle East, and we're tempted to make predictions and then to point fingers and to do it out of our sense of Christian superiority, Christian supremacy. But that is not what is going on in this text. So that's one reason I really struggled with the fact that I had this text lined up today after the events of the last couple days. The other one is that this text actually pushes us much deeper in our understanding, in our analysis of what's going on. And it's easier to stay at more of a surface reading of events, to grieve, to see the evil that has been perpetuated, and to stay there. And to, you know, we may not be on board with the president of France and his, now where he's going to go and he's going to teach him a lesson through increased warfare. But we kind of get it. And then we look at a text like this and we see, that's, you know, this was predicted that was going to happen. But this text is pushing us deeper. It's cautioning us against that very thing and against simplifying things this much. So with that as an intro, I just want to get in to a bit of what I read happening here. Last week, Pastor Jen talked about the devouring of widows that was happening by the temple in the time of Jesus, where the widow comes and gives the last that she has as an offering, but she had very little choice in doing so because of the religious aristocracy that had been set up in the temple and the way that the priests and the scribes, those connected to the temple, were taken advantage of those that they were called to serve. And they were living very well off the offerings of these folks in rural Galilee and around the surrounding countryside and these peasant areas. That is one thing that's going on here. The other thing that is in the background of our passage here today is that Jerusalem was also a Roman temple state. And Jerusalem had been an imperial temple state for 500 years up until this time period, going all the way back to the Persians when the second temple was rebuilt in 515, going into the period of Greek rule, first under the Ptolemies in Egypt and then the Seleucids up in the north, and then even proceeding to a certain degree under a brief period of Jewish nationalism and independence, but that was incredibly harsh and brutal nevertheless, under the Hasmoneans, right up before the Romans in 63. The second temple, from 515 all the way up until the time of Jesus here, was largely not good news for Jewish folks. But there was no getting around it. Their religion was centered in it. Their banking and their economics all went through it. Their very identity, their very way of life was connected with this temple and those who were leading it. And so it must have been extremely confusing for Jewish folks, especially for poor Jewish folks outside of Jerusalem, who, one, this temple was continually being improved, rebuilt. It was an architectural wonder, one of the major wonders in the ancient Mediterranean world. Herod the Great, when he came to rule in the 30s BCE and up till 4 BCE, embarked on massive building projects, especially on the temple and some surrounding building projects, to build it up. Well, where does that labor come from, that conscripted labor? Where does the wealth come from to build a temple like that? And so the people in the surrounding area were suffering precisely because of the temple, because of the excessive taxation and tributes that were required, not to mention all the tributes that were being funneled directly to Rome, but also to make the religious aristocracy their lifestyle work, and to build up this temple, this center of national identity and pride that but only really benefited a few. So the temple was complicated for the Jewish people at this time. It had been corrupted, and yet it was very much the center, the source of their identity. And so we understand when we read early in this passage, you know, Jesus throughout his ministry here has been quarreling and has been confronting those who are connected with the temple and this temple state. And so he thinks that his disciples should start to understand that. He has just pulled them aside and explained what has happened to this widow, pointed out to them that she had to give her very last penny, something that we are tempted, that we just kind of read as a real act of faithfulness, but actually he is condemning the religious leadership at that time with what she is forced to give up. And he teaches, he pulls his temples aside, he wants to give them eyes to see what is happening. And so we should read 13:1 in these verses as connected actually to that story. So he comes out of the temple after sharing this with them, and one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." It's kind of a humorous passage, because they just missed everything that Jesus said. They're still impressed. A part of me gets this. I'm from rural Minnesota. I can remember as a kid driving up to the Twin Cities and how exciting it was to start driving up 35 heading north. And when you start to see on the skyline the really tall buildings, it was always one of the highlights for me of the year, the couple times that I get to come up here with my dad. And I would be so excited, so impressed. And you come from Blue Earth, Minnesota. I mean, what comes from Blue Earth, Minnesota? And you start to drive up, and you see that. And so I get some of the enthusiasm for these disciples who are largely from Galilee and peasants from the surrounding area coming in, and oh my gosh, they're confronted with the temple of God, this architectural wonder. And you're just not making the connections at that time. Even if Jesus is trying to make it for them, they're not getting it. The temple is very much their world, their identity. So I remember that. And then I remember having conversations with Sulgi, because I've been here for a number of years now, but it still to me feels like a big city and impressive. And I'd be talking to Sulgi, and she'd always call this a small town. And I'd be so offended. What do you mean this is a small town? But then I went to Seoul, and then I was really impressed. And just walked around in awe. And then I got it. This is a small town. But in Seoul, that is something else. Another time I had an experience in Chicago, and I was there with one of our former interns, Riz. And we'd be walking downtown. We were taking a class downtown. And I would just be looking up, just amazed. And we'd walk, and he'd keep hitting me, like, "Knock it off. You're embarrassing me. You look like a tourist." So I'm easily impressed with this sort of stuff, with architectural wonders, with big and tall buildings. And it probably has something to do with coming from a more rural area. So I get the temples here. But Jesus responds to them. You see, in their very response, they had just betrayed themselves. They have just given away that they did not get what Jesus was saying. They did not get his teaching. This temple is not that impressive. And it's ultimately not real. It is fleeting. And so he says, then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." Jesus is attempting to dislodge from these disciples the sense of permanence, of ultimacy, of inevitability of the system that they are a part of. He's trying to help them see that this is a temporary thing built on the exploitation of many to benefit a few. And so he takes them out of Jerusalem, over to the Mount of Olives. It's a hill overlooking. He sits with them. It's a space where he could actually sit, and from the other side, look at the temple, look at the city. And so he's opposite the temple. He has Peter, James, John, and Andrew. And, you know, I'm sure they've been wrestling with his comments that he just made about the temple, that not one stone will be left upon another. You can feel this here in their question. Because for them, the temple is their entire life world. What would it mean for the temple to fall? I mean, it would actually mean the end of the world as they know it. But that's the problem. They can't imagine life outside of it, even as they're exploited by it. They have a codependent relationship with the temple, this very thing that is hurting them. So they ask him, as they've been wrestling with this, "Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Okay, maybe there's something to what you're saying. But then, how do we know? What do we do? Help us to understand. And so Jesus begins to say to them, "Beware, watch out, that nobody leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he.' and they will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines, and this is but the beginning of the birth pangs. Okay, so does that clear things up for the disciples? It's kind of a cryptic answer, and it leaves us asking some deeper questions about what is happening here. If this isn't just about some sort of future apocalyptic events, what is Jesus actually talking about? What is his point? What does he want his disciples to hear and to receive and to understand? In 66 to 70 AD, 40 some years after Jesus, is that right? Yeah, about 40 years. The temple actually was besieged. There was a revolt by Jewish nationalists, those who had been arming themselves for some time. There were so many of these little revolts that were happening throughout the countryside and throughout Roman rule in Judea. You have to understand, this is always in the background, and this is always an option for these colonized Jewish people because their territory, their place is occupied. And it is so, so damaging. There is trauma there. So this is always a live option. This is something that on the one side, Jesus is struggling with and wrestling against the religious aristocracy and their connection with Roman rule. On the other side, he's very aware of and struggling with the real temptation to draw towards some sort of revolt against Rome. In 66, this actually happened. It had been simmering and it finally exploded. One thing that happened was an immediate cessation of any tribute to Rome, any sacrifices to the emperor. That is immediate call to war in this context. They just quit giving sacrifices. Second thing that happened is they drove out all the priests and the religious aristocracy, drove them out of the temple. Third thing that happened is they burned all the records, mainly records of debt. So this was how it started, and predictably, Rome came to shut it down, as they knew they would. Rome came in 66, a few months later in that year. But the Judean insurgents was successful, and they drove them out. And so for about a year, year and a half, there was a period again where the Jewish people there had some independence and were ruled here. But of course they knew that Rome was going to come back. They were not going to give it up this easy. So they waited and they prepared. And sure enough, at one point, Rome sent a delegation, an army. They started coming through Galilee, heading south towards Jerusalem. Scorched earth policy, were burning everything in sight and destroying villages. And as they headed south, civil war broke out in Rome when Nero died, and they had to turn around and go back. So they had a little more time. It is, scholars think that this book was probably written in 69 AD by Mark and his community up in Galilee, that he was a part of, this discipleship community trying to follow the way of Jesus, that this was written during that time period where they knew Rome was coming back, and there were folks going throughout the countryside, and they were recruiting people because they were going to take up arms, and they were going to cast off Rome, and they were going to do it by picking up arms. So Mark, is likely in a context writing where he is wrestling with this very real temptation for his community to go and join. Of course, the other temptation would just to kind of be to give in to Romans. And so it's kind of they're in a difficult spot. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And people are taking sides. And you'll read later about the cost to family and relationships and whatever you choose. And so Mark is drawing on this oral tradition of Jesus. He's hearing the stories. You know, up until this point, it's just all these stories that have been shared. And the story of this time here with Jesus. But he emphasizes something really particular here. many will come and say, I am he. They will claim to be the Messiah who is going to liberate us. They will try to recruit you to their movement. And there will be wars and rumors of wars. There will be rumors of Rome coming again. And these are going to continue. But do not be alarmed. Do not be afraid. These are inevitably going to take place. This temple is going to fall. How much is your identity lodged in this temple and the continuation of the Roman temple state? Or the temple state even under Judean rule? See, Mark sees, and I think through the implications of Jesus' witness and ministry, gets that this isn't going to work anymore. It has been compromised from the very beginning, and we need to figure out a new sort of identity, a new relationship with Yahweh. And so he counsels them to wait, to bear it, to go through it, but that this is not the end. It is just the beginning. And that there is a better time coming. And so apocalyptic hope, like we have in this passage, comes in a context where there are few options left. All you can do is look towards the future and hope in your God to deliver you at some time. But there's no getting around going through it. So this is a context that maybe for some of us here, it touches home. And for many others of us, like myself, who have grown up white and American, we have no way of conceiving the sort of thing that these disciples are wrestling with here. And if we are too quick to read it through the lens of a sort of Christian supremacy, we are going to do damage to this text, and we are going to do damage to people all over the place. But if we get that this is written to a people in a context where they don't have many options left, and there is war breaking out all around them, and they don't know a sense of identity apart from the temple, then we can start to understand what is at stake in this reading, and we can try to figure out what this is saying for us today. Come back to some of the things I opened with and wrestle a bit, just ask a few questions about what a text like this, how it speaks to us today and what it means for us today. I think the first question that it raises for me when I'm reading it, especially as I'm listening to the disciples, is what is our temple? What is our temple state? What are we connected to in a sort of codependent way where even though we know it's not good for us and it's hurting us and it's harming us and it may even be exploiting us, we can't, it's still in us. We can't let go of it. What is the Jewish temple? What is that for us? I don't think much has changed since Martin Luther King Jr. famously identified the three evils that intersect and pervade American society. He, in his Beyond Vietnam speech, he talked about the way that racism, white supremacy, and militarism, and capitalism all come together, both here, domestically, to especially exploit and harm black bodies, African American, and indigenous bodies. And then around the world, how it enables and funds wars all over the world as long as those wars are happening in areas that are not white, largely in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Africa. That these three things, and then that all of those are connected to profit, capitalism, and that there is money to be made through these wars, and that the ideology that continues to allow it to happen is white supremacy, is racism. This is religious in this country. You know it's religious because when you start to poke at it or name it and its effects, the reaction is immediate. It's a gut reaction. It's instinctual. And it has nothing to do with the facts. Nothing. We just want to defend our way of life. We don't like to pull back the veil and see what our way of life is connected to, these three things. But if we do, even after we've done the harder work of analysis and consciousness raising, there can still be an instinctual reaction to want to defend a part of it and not look real hard for all of us as American citizens, how in one way or another we are connected to it and we benefit from this in some ways. Others are more deeply harmed by it. But all of us, our souls are ruined through being connected with this in some ways, but we're also conditioned to be connected to it, just as the disciples were conditioned to be connected to the temple state. The other reason it's religious for us is because white supremacy comes out of a history of Christian and European supremacy that was always over and against Islam in the European world. There was a strong, all these religious wars that were happening over there, and the fear of Islam as it was in encroaching at the gates of Vienna, and as it was present in Spain and in the south and in Greece, and as it took Constantinople, it became Istanbul. All of this shaped the psychology, the crusades that preceded it. And so there was a religious fervor and a warfare that was built into folks as they were coming and started to explore and to conquer lands like this that then morphed into white supremacy. But it's connected to all of these things. So this is deeply theological, it is deeply religious, and it is still in us in one way or another. This, I suggest, is our temple. And is what our wealth and our way of life remains connected to. The second thing then, given this, and as we start to see what's going on here, and as we move on in the passage, who is this text addressing? You see, for myself, as I look at this text, I can't get around the fact that I occupy more of the place or the location of Roman citizens than I do the actual people that this text is being written for. Those whose land is occupied, a military occupation, who face very, very difficult decisions. I thought about this a lot yesterday as I was watching what was going on with these events and some of the talk about Syria that was happening again. It brought our attention back to the Syria civil war. All that's happened there. If we don't go back a little further and understand some of the history that gives rise to that, we're not going to get it. We can go back to the period of colonization that divided that country. We can go in that region to the late 70s and early 80s and American and Soviet Union involvement in the areas of Afghanistan and other areas that started to give rise to certain Sunni extremism in that area. Or we can look at 2003 and the invasion of Iraq, and what that did to start causing sectarian strife between Sunnis and Shiites, and how we were not prepared and we fanned the flames of that. And we created an almost impossible situation for Sunnis living in that region who did not want to get on board with Sunni extremism, but they were also being persecuted by the Shiite government, and they had American troops in that area too. There is no way to win for Sunni folks in that region if they did not jump on board with the Al-Qaeda cell that started to emerge after our invasion there, and then as that gave rise to ISIS and split off into that in Syria. And so right now we have a major humanitarian refugee crisis where half of 250,000 have already been killed in Syria, but half of that country now has been turned into refugees, 4 million people looking for a home. And what happened Thursday and Friday, the really devastating part of this is they are going to be scapegoated and they are going to be blamed for this as they try to run away from the very thing that is tearing their country apart that our hands are not innocent of in this country. European countries' hands are not innocent of what is happening there. You can also trace the cash flow to some of our key allies. There's so many ways where we are complicit in what is going on there. And it is the refugees trying to escape from that place, these 4 million, who are now going to be scapegoated through Islamophobia. And this is what it means by this continual escalation of violence, the spiral of violence. And so then we send in more drones. And then we continue to kill innocent civilians. It is innocent civilians all over the case and innocent Sunnis and Shiites in these areas being pushed out that are going to pay the price. This is who this text is talking about in our context today. These folks whose country is ripped apart by war and who don't have a good option. All they have is some sort of future apocalyptic hope for something new. So Jesus and Mark, writing about Jesus, is trying to give his people that in a sense of identity and give them some courage and strength to bear it, but to not fall into some violent reactionary extremism, even though it's tempting, even though it's very tempting at this point. And for the rest of us, how can we see that challenge? How do we grieve with the innocent civilians all over that are caught up in the crosshairs of this war? And how do we also grieve the various ways through our tax dollars and through our silence and so many other things where we're also complicit in some of this, and how this poisons our soul here in this country as we continue to struggle with the legacy of colonialism and of white supremacy and racism? Just this morning again, we hear another report in Minneapolis of an unarmed black man that was shot. I mean, it continues on in this country, but we have to sit with this and struggle with this and recognize that all of these events are connected. But he ends with birth pangs, and I want to close there with that for us today, because it is a sign of some sort of hope in the midst of all of this, that something new can still come out of it, that we can still try to create and embody and live into something different. I thought one of the most amazing events this past week that I was thinking about earlier in the week is what's happened. There was some backlash, but what happened in Missouri and the student protests, and it's happening at Yale. I mean, we just saw a college football team, largely African-American, take down a president who was unable to deal with the racial incidents and the racial hatred that had been happening on campus, just by standing up united, saying, "We're not going to play until he steps down." Remarkable. A sign of hope. And then, of course, the struggle ensues. But we're seeing some of these movements also in the midst of the wars and rumors of wars that are happening around us. So we need to take heart. We need to have courage. We need to come together. We need to be aware. We need to be awake. We need to watch what's happening and not give up the fellowship with one another to give us eyes to see and deepen our love and our courage and our conviction. Amen.
Amen.
Please pray with me. Gracious God, we give you thanks for your word, for this text, for the ways that it opens our eyes, that it challenges us, even as we mourn the events of the last couple days in Beirut, in Paris, in Baghdad. And we also mourn and grieve the evils that give rise to things like this as well. God, help us to both grieve and to be aware, to understand, to learn more about our own history, about our location, about the connection of all these things to each other. Help us to cry out for those who are in pain, and then to recognize the deep pain that is within us as we are connected in some way, as we are in exploitative, codependent relationships with the very things that harm us in our society. Give us the courage, Lord, to walk away, to name it, to speak to it, and to cast it off. Lord, just as you walked with your disciples and you challenged them and you were patient with them even when they didn't get it, please walk with us. Keep on unveiling what's true, what is real, the inbreaking of your kingdom, of your reign in our midst, so that we can be your good news, your salt, your leaven in this world. And we lift these things up in your name. Amen.